seems to be working too. Right. Well, the subject of my talk today is the pastoral pipes. This is a subject that's interested me, I suppose, for 3 or 4 years. And as Brian was saying, we understand that the pastoral pipes are, if you like, the missing link in the evolutionary chain between the early pipes played in Scotland and Ireland, which may have been a bit like the gaita that you find in Spain now, with an octave and a few notes, and the union pipes of the 19th century and the Uilleann pipes of today. So I'm going to talk first about the written sources, then about the instruments, then about what was involved in getting a period instrument playing again. I'm going to talk about Geoghegan's Tutor, which is the book that brought the pastoral pipes to people's attention and I think has had a bit of a bad rap. I'm going to talk about tuning and what this all teaches us about 18th century music and in fact about the music that we play today. And then, of course, as a matter of what we still don't know. I suppose to warm up, I should perhaps play a couple of small pieces to give some idea of what the instrument can do. And the amazing thing about this instrument is that you can play it either like a Scottish pipe or like an Irish pipe. Pipe if you take off the foot joint. Simple as that. And this is one of the reasons that Uilleann chanters today have got this tenon on the bottom. Now, Jimmy wanted me to play the flogging reel, which is a suitable tune for this period because you find it in the Vicar's manuscript as the flagon reel. Already an instrument of about 1780, the makings, the very solid makings of the later union pipes. And of course there were many innovations on this. As you can see, this chanter is unkeyed and there's only one regulator. But basically as an Irish pipe it works, and as a Scottish pipe it works, and as we'll see it does other things too. Now, what happened in the earliest days is a matter of speculation, of course. But there are many, many places in Europe that have got an instrument which plays an octave plus a few notes, the gaita, the cornemuse, and so on. And this is only to be expected from the point of view of organology, because a bagpipe is basically a sham in a bag. And if you go and speak to the people who do history of shams, they'll tell you that in the 15th, 16th century, shams would play a few second octave notes depending on the reed and the player. And if you look at our oldest traditional tunes, you find that they use an octave and a bit. But of course, by the second quarter or so of the 18th century, you find evidence of a more developed chanter. And there's no doubt in my mind that the influence for this came from France, where people developed the charm into the oboe during the 17th century. The Hotteterre family were the people who made much of the running in here. And of course, with the wars of religion, many of the French oboe makers ended up being driven out of France in the late 17th century to London, where they set up shop. And so what I reckon happened is that either somebody put a straight-top oboe into a set of border pipes, or else somebody was making pipes who also made oboes. And this happened much later. James Kinnaar, for example, in the 1770s is described as being an oboe maker. The border pipes, I suppose regulars at this festival should need no introduction to that, but basically they're Highland pipes played with bellows. They were overwhelmingly the most common type of pipe found in Scotland in the 18th century. The full-scale Highland pipes were more expensive and rarer, and the pastoral pipes were also rarer. And there's a great tradition that's now being revived. This is a picture of old Jarthy Syme, who was the Dalkeith town piper in the 18th century. And he was a contemporary of the travelling piper Jamie Allen, whose biography has now been put online by Google Books, if you want to go and read that online. So there's a previous tradition of a single octave bellows blown pipe in Scotland. Now this is a picture that Brian McCandless put together, which shows in the middle a number of pastoral chantos. Above that there's a chanto from a Grand Bourbonnais, which is a type of French cornemuse, which plays an octave plus four notes, and above it there is a baroque oboe, and you can see a reasonable amount of similarity between the layout of the finger holes, the reed, and so on and so forth. Second from the bottom is a modern Ilan chanter in E-flat. And you can see how they all basically line up. There is clearly, however the borrowings and ideas flowed across in the 18th century, there is much commonality. The earliest written source that we have for pastoral pipes appears to be 1728 with the Beggar's Opera, which was popular in London, and you can see there on the right there's a chap playing the pipes. We don't know whether that was a full two octave instrument or an octave and a bit, but during the 18th century pastoral things became popular. As people moved into the town, the new urban bourgeoisie felt nostalgia for the simpler country life, and we find a number of references to that through the 18th century. So the main written source that we come to first is the Complete Tutor for the Pastoral or New Bagpipe by John Gagan in 1743. Now this is the first book of bagpipe music published, and it may be significant that it's for the pastoral pipe rather than the border or the Highland pipe, although as we'll see a number of the tunes in it run perfectly well on the border or Highland instrument. Now what Gagan describes is an instrument with an open end which has got a range from low C to third octave D, so that's two octaves plus a note. And interestingly, it's got A drones. Now there was still a piper playing an Ilan set with A drones in Newcastle up until the 1920s, so this wasn't completely unknown, and it perhaps suggests that this was a border pipe to which a new chanter was adapted. There's an introductory text which describes a number of the gracings that you can play with it, including the Highland piper's birl and the Ilan piper's shake on second octave E. And there's a repertoire which is a mixture of traditional Scots stuff, traditional Irish stuff, popular airs, and some pieces for the oboe. There's the frontispiece of the tutor, and you can see that the chap there is presented as being in the high fashion of the day on the veranda of a smart country house playing the bagpipes. This is spin doctoring. This is the instrument for the new upper middle class. Gagan recommends that people interested in learning the pipes, he said many people were interested in learning the pipes but they couldn't because of the lack of tuition, so he's providing the tuition through the book. And as for the instruments, his friend John Simpson at the Strand, who also supplies oboes, will happily furnish you with a set of pipes. So I've got here one or two of the tunes from Gagan's tutor. And to try and give some feel for the melodies that people were playing in the mid-18th century, this first tune here, the major, is one that you find in every single one of the 18th century pastoral manuscripts. It was clearly a favourite, and it seems to have been not so much a single tune as a framework for people to improvise. By the time you get to the Sutherland manuscript 40 years later, he's got a version with 22 parts in it. So this is basically how to go about playing jigs for dance music with your own variations. Thank you. can see that will run perfectly well on the Highland pipes as well. Now, it's not clear whether one's supposed to be playing crans or burls in this last part here. So I tried to play crans first time through and burls the second time through, and the burls are a bit ungainly there, but they're what's described in the text. Perhaps people played both crans and burls back then. Here's one of the pieces in Gegen that has aroused the most interest. I suppose I should at this point mention Hugh Cheap's book, which is formally being launched tomorrow, but there's a whole chapter in here on the pastoral pipes, and in fact I nicked a number of his illustrations from the CD in the back of the book to illustrate this talk. This is definitely worth a read. And Hugh points out in his book that this piece here, a bagpipe concerto called the Battle of Ochrim, or the Football March, is interestingly reminiscent of Piebrach. There's some ways it is, and there's some ways it isn't. See what you think. Set of variations. No, there isn't exactly the same theme developed through it. But then if you go back into the 18th century, there's quite a number of different styles of variation sets. And in Irish music, of course, there's a greater range than you find with the structures of Scottish Piebrach. So what else do we have? Here, for example, is the Humours of Westmeath. This is another of the favourite tunes, and clearly an Irish one, which you find in a number of the 18th century manuscripts. And it's interesting in that throughout all these manuscripts, the tunes that you find are a mixture of Scots and Irish, plus other fashionable stuff from the time. I think we'll skip that. And so there's the bagpipe concerto called the Battle of Ochrim, or the Football March. Now, one of the things that people have objected to about Gegen is that there's a whole lot of tunes in odd keys, like F and B flat. So people have said, surely Gagan wasn't that knowledgeable about the pipes. Surely he was just somebody who played the oboe and he collected a few tunes and he put them together in a book because he was a hack, basically trying to just dash off a publication for money. Well, one of the things that I discovered, in fact, by accident when Roderick was visiting me, is that with this chanter, you can in fact play in funny keys, because it is, after all, a baroque oboe. So if you take a traditional Scottish tune... Sorry, that's not quite stopped off. Do this without going... Suppose we transpose it down a tone. Works fine, doesn't it? And I just did that and it just worked, and that was one of those aha moments. But sure you can play this in F, sure you can play it in B flat. Now you can't do it oral D drones and not have it sound really, really muddy. But if you've got an instrument with A drones, right, and you can tune these up just a semitone to B flat, then tunes in B flat should work just fine. Assuming, of course, that you've gone and spent a year actually getting able to play really, really fast in the key of B flat. The instrument will do it, it's down to the piper. Anyway, have you handed round the... We've got a number of handouts here, because there's the thing that actually got me interested in the pastoral pipes first was that I was in the National Library of Scotland killing a rainy afternoon, and I basically went to the catalogue and looked for the 18th century music and dug out those items that were unfamiliar, and one of them was this manuscript which had been classed as union pipe music, but it's got a significant number of tunes which have got a low C in them. And that told me, of course, that this was pastoral music, so I went to the museum folks and bought a photocopy and persuaded them to give me permission to scan it and put it online. And at my website, www.piob.info, you can download this manuscript as well as Gagan and many, many other goodies. And so I wrote this little piece, The Pastoral Pipe Repertoire Rediscovered, for Common Stock, the Journal of the Lowland and Border Pipers Society, back in December 2005. Giving a first appreciation of what the pastoral pipe repertoire looked like, because up until then people had thought that, with the possible exception of Gagan, the actual repertoire of the instrument had been lost. And after that appeared online, I got an email from somebody in America who said that he'd seen something similar in the Mitchell Library in Glasgow. So I duly went to the Mitchell and I found the Sutherland manuscript, John Sutherland's tune book, which has got hundreds of tunes, mostly Scottish, many Irish, variation sets, popular airs, and an awful lot of minuets, right? Lots of people played minuets in 1785. There are three pastoral tunes in that they're multi-octave tunes with low C, and the rest are perfectly playable in the modern Uilleann pipes. And this seems to give one an indication that as you go from Gagan to Advocates to Sutherland, the use of the low C is dropping off. People are playing the thing more and more like a modern Uilleann pipe and less like a two-octave pastoral pipe. So I published an article on this, the Sutherland manuscript in Peterborough in 2006, and there's also a handout copy of that article. And I'm going to play some tunes from Advocates and Sutherland a little bit later once I explain what's going on with tuning and reading these instruments. There are a number of interesting later sources. Irish pipers here will surely be aware of the O'Farrell's Pocket Companion. This is widely considered to be the first book published in Ireland on the Irish pipes, isn't that so, Sean?
Published in London.
Okay, but 1804. And O'Farrell was a music teacher and performer. He taught and played on stage in London. Oscar and Malvina was an opera that was a smash hit in 1791. And if you look at his later books, his collection, you can find a number of the tunes from that opera are notated in that book. You can see here there's a very dandy photograph of a chap done up in stage costume, and that appears in fact on the frontispiece of this book. Later sources, O'Farrell's Pocket Companion, these are four volumes which came out between 1805 and 1810. There's the Marquis manuscript, which Hugh rescued from oblivion when he bought it along with a set of pipes, of pastoral pipes, dating back to 1828. These are now in the National Museum of Scotland's collection. And there's the Miller manuscript from 1830. Robert Miller was a chap who had been a military piper, joined the army at the age of 10, served for 40 years, retired at 50, and the regiment bought him a set of Union pipes made by Robert Reed. And that's now in the museum's collection, along with the manuscript that came with it. The manuscript is interesting. The first 60 tunes or so are actually for the Northumbrian pipes. And then in 1830, the date of his retirement, he starts a new page saying Union Pipes 1830, and then you've got a series of tunes that get progressively more difficult as he gets to grips with the instrument. And that's interesting because it's got some of the, as far as I'm aware, the first ever notated regulator playing, which is very, very vigorous. It's very oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, sort of in the Leo Rowson style. Definitely foot-tapping regulator playing. And then you've got Cuckley's Tutor in 1840, which is perhaps the first modern tutor for the Union Pipes. And all of these are scanned and available for download on my website, by courtesy of various people who've supplied copies. So if you want to see what late pastoral pipes look like, this is perhaps about 1780, a very, very simple instrument, two drones, one of them folded back through the stock, four-key regulator and unkeyed chanter. By the time you get to 1828, the instrument in the National Museum's collection is a wonderful, gorgeous piece of engineering with two regulators. It's still got a foot joint, although the foot joint isn't actually used in any of the tunes in the McKee manuscript. They can all be played straight off on the modern Union pipes, and it's got a key chanter. There's a number of other interesting sources. This is one that Brian McCandless dug up. Brian was the pioneer in trying to get the pastoral pipe to before the public's attention. He made himself a replica and played it at North Hero about 10 years ago for a couple of years at the festival there. And this is one of the copies of paintings that he dug up, The Dance of the Little People by William Holmes Sullivan in the early 19th century. And as you can see in this particular painting, the end of the chanter is open. And so that clearly indicates that it's a pastoral rather than a Union pipe. And there are a number of other references that I'm sure Sean can tell us about to the long chanter up until about World War I. And I believe the last reference in Ireland to the long chanter is in Cork in about 1916. Something like that, or 1912.
Richard Hennebrey. He was on his way to the States, he was playing on a long open chanter. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Hennebrey played to the pipes himself, but he was on his way to America, so he couldn't stop. But the important thing is that Hennebrey would have known, he wouldn't have commented on it, except it was unusual.
Well, I've no doubt it was a bit unusual by then, but the last trace of the living tradition, I managed to hunt down two or three years ago. Sam Greer is an old man living in South Carolina who came from a traveling family. Greer is the gypsy version of McGregor. And his father and grandfather played a pastoral set between World War I and World War II, traveling around Scotland. And they no longer had anybody who could make reeds for it, so they used a cane practice chanter reed with a wire bridle on it, which made the thing sort of work. But Sam, as a youngster, remembers this being played. He's now in his 80s, and he was overjoyed when Brian McCandless produced his pastoral replica 10 years ago in North Hero. So there is some link to the living past, however tenuous it is. As for the instruments, the most convenient source is Hugh's book, a wonderful source of material. There's a number of pastoral and early union sets in a number of collections, with the biggest collections in the National Museum of Scotland and at the Chantry at Morpeth. And there's a number of people who have made replicas, Brian McCandless, Sean Folsom, Michael McHarr, Chris Bailey and John Swain. And up until now, nobody, as far as I'm aware, had been able to get an actual period instrument playing properly. And so people made copies and reamed the finger holes and moved the finger holes around and so on and so forth so that they could get the thing to play. So the problem of how you readed a pastoral chanter remained an open one, and it kind of became notorious as one of those problems that nobody really wanted to tackle. Anyway, I got a couple of sets that were sold at Sotheby's in 1994. They were bought by Ken McLeod and John Hughes. And Ken part restored one of them but couldn't get proper reeds running in them. John Hughes didn't restore his set. I bought them both last year. And I've since managed to get things going a bit. The first problem that I had with this instrument was getting the bass drone reed going, because the bass drone folds back through the stop, and this means that the airway is very rough, and it's notorious, in fact, in these instruments that it's hard to get a bass drone reed. So in the end, I basically borrowed an elder reed from another old set. But the big problem with the old pastoral chanters was that people reckoned that you always had the C and the E out of tune. And people struggled to try and get pastoral chanters to play with modern Ilian fingering, and they don't. So this was always a fool's errand. But the breakthrough actually came here last year, at least the first conceptual breakthrough, because I got a bottle of narrowbore D reeds from Joe Kennedy, who had made them as part of a reed making class at Milton Malbay last summer. And Hamish brought along his two pastoral chanters, the Waterloo chanter plus a plain wooden one that he'd picked up in a country sale. And what I found to my surprise and delight was that all four chanters, the two chanters that I now own, plus the two in Hamish's collection, played pretty much the same with pretty much all the reeds. And this told me that there was something stable there, and that we were perhaps making wrong assumptions about what the reeds should be like and what you should try to do to reeds and what you should expect in terms of tone. So this certainly got me thinking, and basically the next thing that I did was to go and visit John Swain, and we played my chanters against his chanters and all our reeds in each of the chanter, and it became completely clear that this instrument, at least, is not optimised to play an open scale in tune, because as you will have heard earlier, it plays as an Ilian pipe pretty perfectly in tune, provided I play the C's differently. You see, the C nat has to be fingered like the Pibroch high G, just with the middle finger of the left hand down and the first finger and the third finger up. And if I try and play the normal C nat, then of course that sounds horrible. Similarly, if I want to play the C sharp, I can't just play the closed C sharp that you play in an Ilian chanter with just the first finger raised. I have to play it like a recorder with the thumb open and the first two fingers of the top hand down. Which is why I can't really play tunes in D at all fast on this. It's obviously going to take some months or years to get used to playing a completely different scale with C sharp. But given that you have got that scale, right, it's pretty much in tune. And so you can't expect it to be in tune with the foot joint arm, right, because you've got different edge effects in different registers, and so of course the E and the F and the second octave are going to be flat. And you can't get around that, and that's just the basic physics of the instrument. So the realisation is that there are basically three modes of operation for a pastoral set. The first is just playing it like a Highland chanter. And that works just like a border pipe. And the second is playing it as an Uilleann pipe. And the third is, if you like, the not the Highland pipe compatibility mode or the Uilleann pipe compatibility mode, but the oboe compatibility mode. And this set just simply isn't built for that. And if you try and play, for example, obviously a leak there, then that just doesn't sound right because of the F and the E being flat. So what this tells us is that you can build a pastoral pipe that will be in tune, open in the second octave. And in fact, John Swain built one. When he made a copy of this, he, first of all, it turned out he moved the C finger hole up the chanter by 3 millimetres. And although he doesn't recall it, he clearly must have reamed out the E hole a bit more when he was voicing the chanter, so that in the second octave the E isn't flat. But as a result, when you play that particular chanter on the knee, it sounds rather insipid. So what this tells us is that you can optimize a pastoral chanter either for playing open or for playing closed, but not for both. And interestingly enough, by the time you get to 1780, what people clearly value is having something that works like a Highland pipe and that also works like an Irish pipe. And once you start to go back and look at the old fingering charts, all this becomes obvious. Now, if I'd bothered to pay sufficient attention to these fingering charts 3 or 4 years ago, then this would have been clear. This is the fingering chart from Gagan, for example. And you can see there in the middle section, second from the left, on the left you could see Nat, which has got the thumb covered and the first two finger holes open. And there's the C sharp, which has got the thumb open and the first two finger holes covered. This is playing open rather than closed, of course. And there is the fingering chart from the Advocate's Manuscript, 1765, which shows essentially the same thing. On the top, C nat has got the thumb hole covered, and underneath it, C sharp shows the open thumb hole and the first two fingers down. And there is the fingering chart from the Sutherland Manuscript, and again, you see the same thing again. So basically what we've been doing when trying to read pastoral chanters was not looking in the right place. The fingering charts would have told us it all along. Can you voice for an open scale? Well, yes you can. And I've got a couple of tracks that I recorded on John Swain's set, which will show you how the music of the Advocate's Manuscript and the Sutherland Manuscript sounds. Let's fire up iTunes. Oops. Let me see if we can get sound through the sound system. Is there a microphone jack here?
So that's two of the reels from Advocates. And then there's another track. I think this is Sutherland, I'm not sure. Right, let's see if we can find the PowerPoint again. One of the things about that particular chanter and reed is that as the reed is weak, it makes it easier to keep the top octave in tune, but it also means that it's difficult to control between the octaves, and as you can hear, one's forever squeaking or losing the octave, because although it's quite possible to go between the octaves in a pastoral chanter, it's harder than an Anilian chanter because you can't use stopping tricks. If, for example, you want to go to first octave A to second octave A, then the sort of thing you do is play an E grace note as you increase the pressure. So it's doable, but it's slightly more intricate, and it's less controllable. So is it going to be possible to read this chanter so that it's less out of tune, played open in the second octave? Well, yes, I believe so, but I don't think we'll get anything that's perfect. The sort of thing I've been doing is making shorter and weaker reeds. The most recent was on Tuesday, and you know, one can decrease the amount by which the second octave E is flat, but still not to the point that it's really comfortable playing open in the second octave, other than for those tunes where people kind of expect the E and the F to be a bit flat anyway, Freyja's Jig or whatever. So, I think we have started to understand what went on with the pastoral sets, how they were readed, how they were played, and how they evolved. We got the fingering charts. We know what's involved if you want to make a pastoral set that plays in D and that plays in tune closed or that plays in tune open. That's something that a pipe maker should be able to do, given what we found out. And this gives us a picture of what the chanter evolution must have been like through the 18th century. We start off with border pipes that will give you an octave plus a few notes. You then either add a baroque oboe or lessons from the manufacturer of a baroque oboe, which to begin with would have played in tune when open. And the only such instrument that I know of at the moment is a copy that Sean Folsom had made of one of the instruments in the chantry by Colin Russ about 15 years ago. And the interesting thing about this is that not only does it play in tune open in the second octave, like John Swain's instrument, but also when you take the foot joint off, it doesn't play a D, it plays a C sharp. Now, it's also the case with baroque oboes that when you take the foot joint off, they play C sharp. And it's also the case in Gagan's Tutor, if we go back to the this tune here in the bottom, Jack's Hornpipe, you can see that there are some low C sharps there. For example, second line of the last bar. And that was one of the arguments that people adduced to say that surely Gagan didn't know what he's doing. You can't play a C sharp on a pastoral set. Wrong. Sean Folsom can play C sharp on his pastoral set, which is a copy of one of those in the chantry. So I think we've just about tied up enough of the loose ends to say that Gagan is acquitted of the charges against him. But we've an unexpected hold up in research. This is a chantry in Morpeth back in September, because I had been planning through last year to go up there and take my bottle of reeds with me and sit down for a day and play my way through all the pastoral chantos in their collection to try and map them to this evolutionary chart that I sketched out in the previous slide, with people starting to play staccato, with chantos being optimized for that, with chantos becoming recognizably modern. And then eventually after 1830 or so, you don't find any more foot joints being made. We should be able to trace that. But the first time I'd arranged to go up to the chantry, Anne Moore couldn't be there because there was a train strike and she couldn't get back from London. And the second time, the heavens opened and the chantry ended up in 3 feet of water. Now, fortunately, Anne and her volunteers got together in time and moved all the exhibits to high ground, but it's going to be some months before anybody can sit down with all these instruments and go through them. So that's a task, I think, for next year. So what does this tell us about chanter evolution in Ireland? Well, the earliest chanter that's got fully modern fingering, you know, that plays as in the Heather Clark Tutor, appears to be the James Kinnear set that Ken MacLeod used to own and that he donated to the NPU and is now played by Ronan Brown. And even so, Ronan assures me this has got one or two strange cross fingerings. A number of the sets that you find up until about the 1840s have got strange oddities and quirks in some aspects of their fingering. For example, O'Farrell, back in 1804, has got a cross-fingered second octave C nat, which this chanter has, by the way. And some notes, he says, have to be played open, whereas in a modern set, the only note that you'd normally play open would be the F nat. So the first fully modern fingering appears to arrive around about 1815 with the earliest sets of Timothy Kinnear. And as late as 1840, if you look at Cuckley's Tutor, you can see the little R's underneath are where you're supposed to rest the chanter on the knee. And you're only resting your chanter on the knee for a bit over half of all the notes there. So the scale is still a bit more fragmented and idiosyncratic than the scales of chanters that you would buy from a modern vendor today. Another point, well, I made this point already. Gagan was accused of not knowing what he was talking about because he notated tunes in F, but as I've already showed, you can quite easily play an F on this set, provided you stop the drones. The chanter will cope with it quite well. In fact, the chanter's fingering is for all the world like the fingering of a recorder. And this may also be significant because the recorder was the most common woodwind instrument played in Scotland and in Ireland in the 17th century. It's only with the arrival of what was then called the German flute, the cross-blown flute, in about 1720 that it started to be displaced. And so a whole generation of people, certainly up until the first pastoral sets were made, were brought up with the idea that woodwind instruments played a C nat as your open thumb note, and the C sharp had to be cross-fingered. So we can rehabilitate John Gagan. We can play an F, you can explain the low C sharp, and just set the A drones. So if you could tune those to B flat, and that explains basically everything. What does this imply for our understanding of Irish music nowadays? Well, if you listen to Kitty's Rambles by Leo Rowson, for example, he plays a C nat throughout, as in fact do some younger players who've learned from him, such as Robbie Hannah. And you find an awful lot of traditional tunes where people play a C nat, where if the music were being produced by someone with a conventional music degree, they put in a C-sharp. Why is this? Well, I think it's quite simple, that if you are playing an instrument like the pastoral set, where the easy open note to play is C-nat, then you will do that, especially if you're playing fast, because cross-fingered notes are fiddly, they make crossing noises, they take extra energy, and if you can get away with playing a note open, then that's simple. So one of the things that I did once I realized this early in this year was to go through all the various sources that I found, and I discovered that the Goodman manuscript, which is a collection of tunes from West Ireland in the 1860s, has got a very strong pastoral flavor to it. There's an awful lot of tunes in there, or one octave tunes, or tunes that use a C-nat. And you find the same also if you listen to Johnny Duran's stuff. It's got a very, very strong pastoral flavor. And again, this isn't surprising. If he learned from his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, going back to West Ireland in about 1800, then it's very likely that his great-great-great-grandfather was playing a pastoral set. You tend to find that the oldest instruments are played in the most remote regions and by the most marginalized communities, because it's the rich merchants in Dublin who can afford the latest offerings of Mr. Kinnear. And if you're living in a caravan in County Clare, then you're more likely to have a set like this than one of these fancy modern multi-keyed offerings. So there's a sense in which understanding how the pastoral instrument played its music can give us a kind of telescope to look back into how music would likely have been in the 18th century, and what that tells us about which tunes came down to us from the 18th century rather than being composed in the 19th. And if I think of all the tunes that are really, really hard to play on this, you know, things like the Bucks and the Salamanca and so on, which really need the C-sharp, these seem, as far as I can tell, to be the product of this great wave of musical innovation in the 1830s and 1840s. So what next? Well, there's been a move over the last 20 years for people to start making flat sets. The people like Jeff Woof and Joe Kennedy have made a, not only made a great business, but have converted many professional pipers to the idea that playing flat sets is the thing to do, that concert sets are basically for pub sessions and not much more than that. So the next interesting challenge is to get more 18th century sets going. Now, many of the sets are, of course, in museums, and that means that you probably can't refurbish them because the museum curator won't let you cut off the bag and put on a new one. But at the very least, the chanter should still be playable. I mean, putting a reed into a chanter and putting it in a bag and playing it doesn't hopefully cause any irreversible changes. What we can do once we've got a better timeline is to look at the manuscript sources again and see if we get anything interesting out of that. And I suppose the great precedent here is the early music movement. The whole idea of historically inspired performance is that once you start performing, for example, Baroque pieces and Baroque instruments, then they sound different and you learn an awful lot more about how they were probably played then. And similarly, I think that once we get back to playing 18th century piping tunes on 18th century instruments, or on good reproductions of them, on faithful reproductions, then I think we're going to learn quite a lot more about our traditions. So, there's the conclusion. The pastoral pipe is the missing link in the evolution from the 17th century ancestor pipes to the 19th century union pipe, you know, the flat sets that are now all the rage. And what I suppose I've learned is that first, it wasn't one single design, but it was a progression. The instrument played by Gagan was no doubt very much like an oboe, whereas this is, except in the way that you finger C and C-sharp, very much like a modern Ilan set. The music also evolves through the 18th century. You go from a tune book with lots of tunes in F and B-flat to a tune book with lots of tunes with low C to tune books that are essentially playable on modern Ilan sets. But right up until the 1830s, you find that the union pipes sold in Scotland still had the foot joint so that you could still play Highland style on them. And you find that at the earliest Pibroch competitions, people turned up with pastoral pipes. You find also that the Highland Society of London supported the pastoral pipes as well as the Highland pipe. And so clearly the pastoral pipe was seen as being an indigenous Scottish instrument. Although you do find some sources, such as the Sutherland manuscript, which refer to the two-octave pipe as the Irish pipes, So it was clearly an instrument that was jointly owned. Both Scots and Irish musicians felt that it was theirs. Next, the footprints in modern Scots and Irish music, particularly the use of C-nats in a lot of the old tunes, start to be evident once we know what to look for. And there's a similar story to tell about Scotland. There's a paper needs to be written about the high G in the Highland Chanter and the various tunings that were used there, the fact that older chanters can give you a sharper G with the open fingering and a natural G with the Pibroch fingering, as it's called, is exactly the analogy of what I've demonstrated here. And it's time to rehabilitate John Geoghegan. Let's just take the sources at face value. They are in fact informative, and they do tell us what was going on back in the middle of the 18th century. So that's all I had to say. If there are any questions?
Yeah, we've got about 10 minutes, and in order to have some structure, you know, if people can put their hands up, and we'd invite them to speak once, and then they'll be good. I'm sure there's loads of things we've talked about. Ross has told us there's a fascinating discourse, and I'm sure everybody's confident that it adds something to it. So who would like to? We have a call in here.
Yes, yeah. Well, I just wanted to ask Ross, do we know anything about John Geoghegan himself? His own personal history?
There are only fragments. There are references to Geoghegans who may have been him or may have been relatives of his in London. I believe one was a performer at Oscar and Malvina.
There was a Geoghegan, that was the 1820s. The only thing I've ever seen about him was in an obituary of a poet called James Spence, who died in 1793. He more or less drank himself to death. And he was supposed to be well, what's new? But he's supposed to be a musical genius. And it was said that he knew Walker Jackson from this town, Piper Jackson. Now, Jackson was born in or around 1722, he was an adult by 1743. Anyway, the point was that the obituaries talked about Mr. Geoghegan visiting Jackson. And he said about Mr. Geoghegan or the pastoral, and he mentioned this with the bagpipe or the pastoral, as Mr. Geoghegan calls it. And there was a tune in 1740s, Geoghegan's Maggot as well, so there was nothing about it. There are John Geoghegans in London at the Inns of Court, and etc., but it was impossible to identify.
I remember Brendan Brennock told me a long time ago that he thought that the Geoghegans and that name was a characteristic name of the West Meath area. And because I pointed out to him that one of the few tunes in the book which had a local reference was The Humans of West Meath. You just told us in fact that that tune is found in other sources as well. I didn't know that. That's because Beacon's what I've just said. That's very interesting. Sean, you would agree that the tune called, is it Geoghegan or Geoghegan's Frisk? Might be a reference to himself.
Oh, it is, yeah. That's the way now people down there would give it, would send it.
Is that a clue as to how he himself pronounced his own name then?
Well, he probably calls it Geoghegan.
Geoghegan, with a short first syllable.
There was a hanged in London for coining Usher Geoghegan. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's any relative, but he obviously pronounced his name in the traditional Irish.
I was firmly told by a friend and other people that he was definitely Geoghegan, just the two syllables, but that's interesting.
No, my father came quite close, well, he crossed the Shannon, but he would have said Geoghegan.
Right.
I just think one thing we talked about the football march, it occurred to me as well that there was something oldish there, or kind of Pibrochy about it. But the interesting thing as well is that in the 17th century, football wasn't widely played in Ireland except in North County Dublin, Fingal, and New County Westmeath. At least we have records from there. And the other point is that there's an account from the early 1700s of two or teams playing and one of them being piped onto the field. And we also have things from the late 17th century of hurling matches where pipers played the teams on. And Jimmy mentioned this morning the hurlers' march, there are several tunes called the some stage when they put below C or below G or whatever it was, was lost, you know, transparently. But again, it's a type of tune that's, you know, attached to a particular practice. And
yeah, you can in fact play this instrument standing up and marching perfectly well. Yeah. And Brian's got a painting in his house of a travelling piper from the 18th century doing just that with a pastoral set.
Yeah, there's two other, I don't know, there's a man, Drew Hamilton, The Cries of Dublin, he has Blind Daniel the Piper, they're playing a pastoral pipes in 1760. It's a pretty good drumming too. And there's a one, a few, I've forgotten the artist's name, a few of the things apart from the 1750s, Tudor. Joseph Tudor, and shows in just one corner. So it's a view of chapel, is it, from the Phoenix Park, and in one corner you can see there's a piper and people dancing, but you can clearly see it's a pastoral pipes. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen those.
I haven't seen that.
But Terry Martin will fix you up with them.
Good.
Yeah,
that's
quite
an enormous painting. It was 6 feet across, and then the scene that was the piper and dancers.
Ross, I did a lot of work on the pastoral pipes. I bought that jewel set, the Waterloo set, as you know, in 1985. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of work in them for 2 years and recorded Rosalind Castle, the tune Rosalind Castle, which goes up to the top B. In 87 on my album Open-Ended, after which I decided that the Irish took basically what was an unreliable instrument, improved it by stopping it on the knee, and made a much more sophisticated instrument, and came to the conclusion that the pastoral pipe died out because it was unreliable, and any further work I was going to do was going to lead me to stopping the chanter on the knee and reinventing the wheel. So I gave up on it in 1987. And I think, you know, I think that from what you're saying and demonstrating just how it plays both ways, which I discovered as well, I think that is the conclusion that I came to, and sort of demonstrates in a snapshot what went on over maybe a period of 100 years in its evolution to becoming what must be the most sophisticated bagpipe in the world, the Uilleann pipe.
Well, it's a shame that the latest pastoral pipes like Mackie's are locked up in museums, because I would expect that an instrument like that would give you a good Highland pipe sound with the foot joint on, and would play perfectly well as an Uilleann pipe with the foot joint off. Mm-hmm. So it would give you the best of both worlds. I think the reason that the pastoral pipe died out in Scotland was quite simply the whole Highland Romanticism movement, yeah, after 1822.
Mm. But why did it die out in Ireland?
Well, it didn't.
It evolved into a better instrument. Well, the
certainly by the 1770s, 1780s, people are making pipes here that don't have foot joints and never had foot joints, because the tenon was clearly decorative rather than mechanical. Mm-hmm. The oldest canard sets, for example, of a tenon, which is chamfered and therefore couldn't have held a foot joint. So clearly by, call it 1780, you have got people making chancels that are not intended to be played open.
Sure. Yeah. I think there was there had to be a period where you necessarily coexisted. You know, I mean, I'm looking at the illustrations you have, a painting from about the 1870s of a pastoral paper by a French Clare painter, and the only paintings that I've found with recognizable Uilleann pipes were all dated from the 19th century, and we're not finding any in the 18th century. There's quite a number. Pastoral pipes all the way. That's not to say that you have to play it, but I mean, the fact is that you obviously have to have a tune going. But I think it's quite correct that 15th century, I think it must
There may also be a social element in that, as you'll have noticed, with the foot joint on, it's significantly louder than with the foot joint off. So if you're using the instrument to play for barn dances or crossroad dances, then you'll want the foot joint on. And if you're using it to play in the living rooms of grand gentlemen in Dublin, you'll take the foot joint off so that you can be more expressive.
I mean, there are references to people White boy used to march in the 1760s, and it's not clear what had been done by a piper. Usually playing the lap of the white cockade or something, but it's not clear what type of pipes in question. You know, I think it's quite possible that it was a pastoral pipe played on the march, as it were. That it be possible that this is what was being played.
Oh, there's no difficulty at all playing these marching.
So
just provided you've got the thing hemmed up enough, tight enough that it doesn't fall out while you walk.
What do you think, Ross, of Colin Russ's explanation of the name half long pipes or quarter pipes, that the chanter is half as long as it used to be before you took the foot joint off?
I'm not so impressed with that. I mean, the half long is always played in A.
I just want to say one thing. That the 1760, upon celebrating Thurles Raid in Carrickfergus in 1760, an Irish poem, and it refers to the Highland pipes as Keeman and Father long pipes. Now, I don't know whether that's any relevance to the half long question, but is it possible that this might be referred to as a possible that people will sometimes translate as long pipes?
So the south of the translation, doesn't it?
I
think we'll surely come to the stage that it's the official starting time.
probably
a few minutes to gather yourselves. Was the next time I can place correctly, and you can continue the discussion about this in private, but I think we'll have to sort of draw to the conclusion. Thank you, Ross, for